This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lissy. Today, we're lucky to have Lissa Young and have the chance to cover a tiny fraction of how interesting she is. She's a West Point grad and trained Army aviator whose workday used to involve flying a Chinook cargo helicopter. In those days, the to-do item might include pulling a rhinoceros out of the Everglades during Hurricane Andrew or flying search and rescue missions in Alaska's Denali Mountains. In her civilian life, she accidentally networked her way into Harvard, where she designed her own leadership doctoral program. And also, because I feel like I have to mention it, she later helped build a craft rum distillery. Now she's back at West Point, teaching a course on, of all things, entrepreneurship. The path back to West Point wasn't an easy one. Today, she'll talk about leadership and teamwork and what she's learned about making things happen, even in a large, structured organization like the military. She'll also share a time in her life where she faced a major turning point and how she powered through. Hi, Lissa. How are you?
Hi, I'm terrific. How are you today, Linda?
Very good, very good. I'm very excited to have you and excited for our chat.
Awesome.
Very good. So I gave a very sort of brief and hardly adequate intro for you. Can you give folks a brief summary of your time in the military, just kind of dipping into sort of some of the training you had from the beginning up through through your service and the types of missions that you were in?
Sure. So I commissioned in the United States Army's Aviation Corps in May of 1986 and went off to flight school. And graduated from flight school in September of 1987 and was sent off to the 4th Infantry Division at Fort Carson, Colorado. And spent about 4 years there and then came back to what they call the advanced course at Fort Rucker, which is the home of Army Aviation, and transitioned into the Chinook helicopter at that time, which was around 1991, and then was assigned to Fort Bragg and the 82nd Airborne Division, where I flew Chinooks for several years. And then after that, was sent off to graduate school to come back to West Point to teach the core leadership course. And did that for 3 years and then headed back out to the Army to attend the Command and General Staff College. And when I was there, I was selected to take command of the Army's only high-altitude search and rescue Chinook unit in Alaska. And so in the year 1999, I headed off to Alaska and took command of that unit and ran search and rescue there for about 3 years. That was about 16 years on active duty.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. And you started at West Point, mm-hmm. and you came there nearly accidentally. Tell me about how that happens, right? Because you may yep. have had an entirely different path, and how West Point wasn't the typical college experience you may have thought you were going to have.
No, not at all. So at the time that so I graduated from high school around the time that they opened up the military academies to women, and my first venture into college was off to a small liberal arts school in the mountains of North Carolina. And then when I was up there, I decided I wanted to be the next Jacques Cousteau. So I transferred to New College in Sarasota, Florida. And as part of that transfer, I went to a field research station in the Bahamas called FORFAR. And it was when I was at FORFAR Field Research Station that I decided that this romantic image I had of being Jacques Cousteau was actually involved real science, and I didn't like it very much. So then I took a look at other opportunities, and I really was at a loss. And then my godmother wrote me a letter that she composed while sitting in the superintendent's box on the plane, which is the hallowed parade field at the United States Military Academy, She was up there with her husband at their 25th graduation reunion, if you will. And she wrote this letter saying, hey, I want you to understand how important this place is. And, you know, it's part of your legacy. Your father graduated from West Point. There's an opportunity for you here that has been paved by women who have fought hard for equality. I want you to think about being a part of an institution that is about what's real, what matters, and what lasts. And it just, it really seized me, this letter, because I was I was very much sort of adrift, and it really focused me. And I thought, well, gosh, okay, I'm going to go to West Point. So I applied, and surprisingly enough, got in. And this was in 1982, and matriculated in the summer of 1982, and then graduated in 1986. Not really anticipating what all of that meant, but just knew that I wanted to be part of an institution that would demand of me more than I thought I could offer. And boy, did I get it. West Point was not a cakewalk.
So you come there, you got your tennis racket and your typewriter, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's what I thought was necessary for college life, and very soon was redirected to what it meant to be socialized into the military. And spent 4 years absolutely shocked by, you know, what was going on around me. I mean, in a positive way. It was just quite an incredible experience, and one that really did tap into all of this potential that I didn't know how to tap into. And so it wound up being incredibly rewarding and exciting and fun and miserable at the same time, but really fun.
And to give people sort of a sense of that, you know, most people are starting college and they're excited about parties and maybe they'll go to class, maybe they won't. how does that work at West Point?
So if you don't go to class at West Point, you get written up. And because it's your place of duty, and the nation is paying you to go there. So our number one, you know, loyalty is to the U.S. public. And so it's considered a violation of your duty if you don't go to class. So there is no skipping class. There's no sleeping in. There's no there's actually no individual agency with respect to those kind of regulations at West Point. So quickly, I stepped right into line and, you know, went to class dutifully.
You learn quickly.
Yes.
And you also sort of learned about teamwork, and in particularly like trust from strangers, which is a really interesting thing that happens in the military. It's very specific. There was a particular thing that happened to you during basic training, right, in that those early days. Can you tell me a little bit about that, week, and sort of about the sort of lovely surprise that you had?
So if I'm remembering correctly, it was there were actually so many, but in basic training, the first 8 weeks where you're sort of getting indoctrinated into this culture, you're divided into squads, if you will. So it's about 12 young people who are challenged with things that, you know, they can't do alone. So they have to integrate and support each other in completing missions and tasks. And I just remember I was really amazed because on a couple of events, whether they be land navigation or, or what we call survival swimming, my squad mates would compensate for those folks who were a little less skilled in that particular task. And I was very impressed with that one time because one week I was assigned as the head laundry carrier or something. And I came up with this elaborate idea for how we were going to deliver laundry at 5 o'clock in the morning. And my squad stared at me with these blank faces and they said, I think we've got a better idea. And it was really interesting because if they had followed, you know, I was trying to be very authoritative and directive because I thought that's what leaders did. But I learned very quickly that being more participative actually creates the conditions for better solutions. And so I heard out everybody's ideas. And from those, we integrated about 3 or 4 ideas about how to get this thing done without getting yelled at. And it was a very humbling experience because I realized that if I let go of power, I actually get more power. And I was super impressed with how folks compensated for each other and leaned in and took care of each other and, you know, had each other's backs. And it was all about the success of the group and never at the expense of an individual. So I think that it was a big lesson for me because I just, you know, I had been part of athletic teams in my high school and junior high and elementary school. And I had experienced that sort of in the abstract, but this was very real to me. And I was very humbled and impressed with the way that this team came together. And it taught me about how to let go in order to be more successful.
And it also sort of drives something home about a different type of leadership, which is peer leadership, which mm-hmm. is we don't really think about too much. But tell me a little bit about how that's different and why it's still really, really important to master.
Yeah, I think peer leadership is very, very challenging. And it's interesting coming back here to the United States Military Academy as a professor of leadership. It's interesting to watch it from this angle. And it's interesting also, I think, because the culture is very different. Like millennials are very different than I was. I'm a baby boomer. And I just remember that peer leadership requires that you not be directive and authoritative, but open and participative and humble and quiet, if you will. And these are the same lessons that these millennials are learning, even though they are wholly more independent than I was, than baby boomers were, or are. And so I think it's a lesson again, and I don't want to repeat myself, but it's a lesson in stepping back a bit and creating space for everyone on your team to participate and contribute. And it was a really profound lesson for me to learn at the quote unquote, you know, United States Military Academy, where you think that it would be, you know, directive and command and control. And it just wasn't. The secret and the sauce is that you need to back off and let go.
And you would develop your leadership skills in another way as an Army aviator. And so flying the Chinook, which is a very complicated machine, and I'm just sort of fascinated by it altogether. For folks who aren't familiar, can you please explain a little bit about what this machine is, why it's so special?
Well, I think it's a special aircraft, first because of its sheer size. It's a 50,000-pound aircraft, and it can pick up tremendous loads, if you will. And I think it also is multifaceted. You can do just about anything with this aircraft, and part of that is because it was designed for that kind of utility. Like it's almost like a transformer, if you will. You can modify it for a variety of missions. And the other thing that I found really amazing about it, because I transitioned into Chinooks from OH-58, the Kiowa, which was a single pilot aircraft. And so I had spent, 6 years flying single pilot, not having to talk to anybody, having to handle radios and navigation on my own. And then boom, I went into the Chinook and all of a sudden there's four other people in the aircraft with me. And it was a little overwhelming at first. I'm like, gosh, everybody, y'all be quiet. I'm thinking, but it really taught me a lot, even more about teamwork, because you have another pilot in the cockpit with you, and then you have a flight engineer and a crew chief in the back of the aircraft managing the mission profile. But this bird can do just about anything. For the most part, I did field artillery gun raids and search and rescue. And those are just two of the many, many missions that aircraft can fly. And I think it was a really powerful lesson for me, again, to let go of my own need to be in control and be truly a part of a team.
And that's also I just want to stress that you're flying these helicopters, this helicopter in very unpredictable environments, in high altitudes, in mountainsides, after hurricanes and things like that. So there's extra things that you can't account for in all of this.
Yeah, I remember I was a part of the Ready Reaction Force at Fort Bragg when Hurricane Andrew hit Florida in 1992, I think that was. And I got called at 1 o'clock in the morning and got up and, you know, packed my bags and went to the flight line. And we took off with a flight of about 16 Chinooks. And, you know, 12 hours later, we were in Miami. And I'll never forget the arrival because, you know, we had to go to Homestead to land because Miami International was closed. But I was amazed at the devastation and immediately knew that we could do a lot of good there, given, you know, given the debris that we saw and the, I mean, everything was just flattened, especially Homestead, if you can remember that. It was just, it was utterly destroyed.
And so, you know, after, you know, several years of flying these missions in high altitudes, you, things stop. You were asked to leave the military because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And then suddenly you're finding yourself on the Alcan Highway, you know, from Alaska back to the United States. You're on this drive. What are you thinking?
That my life is over and I hope I don't wake up in the morning. I mean, I was really pathetic. But I also have to say that it was just incredibly devastating because what I was faced with was deconstructing an identity that had been developed over 20 years and reconstructing myself. And at that point, I didn't think I was capable of doing that. So, you know, I had a big fat bottom quivering lip and all the way down the Alcan Highway. And it took a couple of months for me to kind of get myself together and realize that I could do good in the world not being an Army officer. That was a very, very difficult transition to make and a future to embrace. And I was very reluctant to do it. And not to mention, there was a lot of shame involved. You know, getting kicked out of the military for being gay was very shameful for me. And I think because I had been very open and out about my sexuality and it had just never been an issue. And I just happened to run into the wrong person. And I was, so I felt very shocked and betrayed. And it happened right after I had been selected by the United States Military Academy to come back as a permanent academy professor. And at that time, 100 years ago, I had this little dream of being the first female graduate dean of West Point. And so all of this stuff just shattered, you know, this whole future that I had in line for myself just shattered. And it was incredibly devastating. But I realized one day after feeling sorry for myself for a couple of months that I could sit around and feel sorry for myself forever and nothing would happen. Nothing would change. And so somewhere in there, I decided I've got to put on my big girl britches and get on with my life. So I did.
Well, and it's sort of an incredible transition because you were, you know, in a state of sort of catatonia, you know, and then to go sort of decide, okay, enough of that.
Right.
It's amazing.
After
that, you have to move forward. You will get back to West Point at some eventually, right? But there's some stops along the way. How did you find yourself hawking air traffic control systems in the Middle East?
So what happened was I spent a couple of months, you know, feeling sorry for myself, and then I got a call from. And let me back up and just say I did try to apply for jobs, but something that is very difficult for military people is to translate what they've been doing in the military to civilian jobs, if you will. And I think I was just a terrible job applicant. And I also wasn't very effective at leveraging my network. And part of the reason I wasn't leveraging my network was because I was so embarrassed about A, being outed, and B, you know, being kicked out. And so I didn't leverage the West Point Mafia to get a job in the real world, if you will. So I sort of was slinking around underneath the radar and trying to apply for jobs, and I didn't get a single callback. And so then I thought, okay, I'm going to starve to death in the streets. This is the end of my life as I know it. And I get a call from a cousin of mine who happened to be married to a Raytheon vice president. And she said, hey, you know, Jerry says Raytheon is trying to sell its air traffic control system, this next generation, you know, technologically advanced air traffic control system in the Middle East. Would you be interested in hawking air traffic control systems in the Middle East? And I said, sure. I have no idea. You know, I don't know anything about sales. And the only thing I know about air traffic control systems is as an end user, as an aviator, which happened to be exactly what they needed, because to send a technician in to talk about air traffic control to people who are end users doesn't mean anything to them. So sending a pilot in actually was more effective. I didn't know that at the time, but I was able to articulate in ways the values of this system better than an engineer could. But anyway, so I said, okay, I'll take the job. And off to the Middle East I went and hawked air traffic control systems in United Arab Emirates, in Kuwait, in Qatar, in Jordan, just all over the place, and learned a lot of lessons and still felt completely alien. Like the world of defense contracting and commercial technology just was not who, you know, because I had always worked, like what I did was who I was. And so it was very hard for me to be just be working for a paycheck. I didn't identify with Raytheon. No shame on Raytheon, but I just, you know, I wasn't a software engineer and I wasn't a hardware engineer. And I didn't identify with this identity that I had at Raytheon. And so I was there for several years. And then I think I told you this before, that I got a call from a former colleague of mine, who I had taught with at West Point, who was then at Harvard. And he said, hey, I'm supposed to give a talk here at Harvard about the leader development program at West Point, and I'd love it if you could help me do that. So I said, sure. And that's when my fate began to change.
And when you were at Raytheon, you knew that you were ready for some sort of a shift, and you reached out to a coach. What did that coach tell you?
So frustratingly enough, the coach told me exactly what I knew in my heart, but was too terrified to embrace. After all of this psychometric testing and, you know, interview and all that, she said, you know, you need to be a scholar. You need to go to grad school. And I had always, you know, my whole life, I'd always wanted to get a PhD, and I'd always seen myself as a professor. And, you know, that's the life that had been cut away from me when I got kicked out of the Army. And I just, you know, I think at the time when I got kicked out of the Army, it didn't even occur to me that I could come back to West Point as a civilian professor. Like for some reason that just didn't, I felt like I wouldn't be legitimate, and you know, I just couldn't see it. But after, you know, working with this coach, I thought, well, geez, what am I waiting for? So I remember, you know, listening to her, and then I called West Point and I said, would y'all consider hiring me as a civilian? And you know, they said, the department head said, will you just hurry up? So that's when the big shift occurred.
And I think it's interesting because I think that a lot of the experiences that you have had, like flying these massive helicopters and getting into these insane situations, I think that someone might assume that you wouldn't be afraid of taking a professor job.
Right.
Tell me about...
I think it all had to do with shame, though. Like, I didn't know how to be at, you know, because I had spent 3 years on the faculty at West Point in the mid-90s as an officer. And, you know, there's a big cultural difference between the officers and the civilians. And I just didn't know how to tell that story. Like, how do I show up as a civilian in this environment without having to out myself every other day? And so I had a hard time with that.
And so you decide to pursue your PhD. You apply to graduate schools, and you get some of the unhappy surprises that a lot of people who apply to graduate school. Tell me a little bit about that and sort of your sort of path into where you ended up going.
So yeah, so I wanted to back up a little bit and let you know that when I left Alaska, I immediately applied to grad schools. And didn't get into a single one. I applied to like 20. And So here I was with this coach saying, you know, here you have permission to be a scholar. This is what you should do. So I really gritted my teeth because I'm like, oh, I'm not going to get in anywhere. So I went about the process of applying, and I applied to all kinds of schools and different programs and contacted my old professors from West Point, which was very hard for me because I had to tell them I'm not applying it from the military. I'm applying as a civilian. Everybody was remarkably supportive. And I was still, you know, hawking air traffic control systems at Raytheon, the rejection letters just started coming in. So I applied to about 20 schools and I got 19 rejection letters. And I thought, okay, well, my life's not going to take me to West Point. And I was feeling real sorry for myself. And then one day I was at my office at Raytheon and I get a call from Harvard. And they said, is this Lissa Young? And I said, yes. And, you know, I was just waiting for them to say, we're sorry to tell you, we're not going to accept you. And this very nice professor, Dr. Murnane, said, well, we just wanted to tell you that your story is very compelling and we think you would add a lot of value here. And we want to offer you a position to pursue your doctorate if you would like to accept it. And so, you know, me trying to be very cool, I said, well, okay, well, let me think about it for, you know, a half a second. And he said, additionally, we just want to tell you that your name was forwarded to the president of Harvard and you've been selected by her to be a presidential fellow. So all of your expenses will be taken care of and we will pay you a stipend to attend. And it was just the most unbelievable feeling. I won't ever be able to articulate what that feeling was because I felt like finally, you know, my life, like the gate opened finally, and I was going to get out of this black box that I had been in for 5 years. And it was just unmitigated bliss. And so I said, sure, I'll take that scholarship. And off I went at the age of, you know, 40, whatever it was, to grad school, and spent six of the most deliriously happy years of my life there studying.
And at Harvard, you designed your own program of study. Explain how unique your program was that you sort of helped to push forward. Explain that a little bit.
So I was accepted into the Graduate School of Education, and I knew that in the Graduate School of Education, its mission is to produce teachers who will innovate the education system in America. And so it's an interesting school because it's about change leadership a lot. But I was not a K-12 teacher. You know, I had been a college instructor. And so I wasn't there to study education. But they took a chance on me. And, you know, they knew I was sort of an anomaly compared to the other doctoral students in my cohort who were all, you know, K-12 educators initially. And so I got there and I immediately, because I had had my master's, I earned my master's in social psychology and was very interested in stereotyping and prejudice and its impact on teams' performance. And so I got there and I went to my advisor and I said, I'd really like to not study education. I mean, not study education, but I'm much more interested in social psychology and the social psychology of teams. And so she had a PhD from Harvard in organizational behavior from the Harvard Business School. And so she was totally up for that. And she said, okay, well, let's design your doctoral program then. And so we sat down and we went to the psychology department. We went to her former advisor at Harvard, who was Richard Hackman, who is world famous for teams research. And he said, I'll take her. So we designed a program that allowed me to stay, you know, my home base was the Ed School, but the Ed School let me design courses that were from the psychology department and from the business school, and I cobbled together this doctorate that was about teams. And it was just a wonderful break for me to be able to be accepted to the Ed School because they were so open to that kind of entrepreneurial spirit, if you will. And So I I did that for 6 years, and all, you know, everything worked out great. And I had a wonderful advisor, absolutely wonderful advisor. And got to study under Richard Hackman as well.
it's amazing. And I can't help but be struck that by the fact that pulling that program together also involved, you know, the buy-in of these other professors, these other departments, and on its own is its own version and example of trust and teamwork. That's, to me, I think that's really interesting. Somebody else wouldn't have made the ask for this, but it seems like you trusted that you'd have the support. Am I sort of thinking about that in the right way?
Well, before I decided to do that, I went to the psychology department and I talked to Richard Hackman and I talked to Mazarin Banaji. And Mazarin Banaji is famous for the implicit attitudes test. And both of them were very encouraging because, you know, to cross register at Harvard is not a normal thing. But I think I was able to make the case effectively enough, and both Richard Hackman and Mazarin Banaji said, we'll support you. And it just happened to be that my advisor at the Ed School was a protege of Richard Hackman. So everything just sort of came together. So I could have definitely just put my nose to the grindstone and accepted a degree in education, which of course I have, but you know, accepted the program, the traditional doctoral program. But the registrar and my advisor really worked with me to kind of branch out. And additionally, the other thing that I decided to do, which was a little bit radical, was get a doctoral concentration in women, gender, and sexuality. And so I had to petition the Faculty of Arts and Sciences to allow me to study in their gender program. And so that ended up being a very wonderful experience. And I can bring a lot of expertise to this world, which is, you know, highly masculine and, you know, very gendered, if you will. So I love having that, all of that, you know, scholarship to help serve my activities here at West Point.
Sure, sure. But at the end, a lot of other people wouldn't have even made the ask.
Maybe not, but I also think a lot of other people would have been much more focused. You know? I mean, I was just, you know, I don't think I was as focused. And it was interesting because I did apply to the social psychology programs at West Point and didn't get in. And it was interesting that the education school accepted me because I didn't have any background in it. So I think I found myself sort of a stranger in a strange land, but then decided to align that school with what my true interests were. And so I think that's how it happened. 'Cause almost invariably all of my doctoral cohort were former K-12 teachers. And, I just, you know, I'd never taught K-12. I didn't know anything about it.
So later, with all of this now, later you will return to West Point and teach a class on entrepreneurship. And what's I think it's interesting about this, but when you return to West Point, you have all of these experiences under your belt. You had the sales experience from the Middle East, hawking the air traffic control. You've got these all these experiences navigating Harvard and all of the a very academic environment. And now we didn't go into it, but you had by that point also helped with the rum distillery and making that happen. And so you've got new experiences to build on, to sort of bring to just the idea of leadership.
Well, I think, you know, most of my colleagues here have Army experience and, you know, a huge variety of Army experiences, but how I'm different as a professor here is that I have this, you know, vast array of experiences, both as an Army officer and as a civilian and as an entrepreneur. So I think that's kind of good for cadets to get exposed to. And, you know, it's one of the reasons that the service academies actually have civilian professors. It's to expose cadets and it's to, you know, to different perspectives, as well as reduce that civil military divide, if you will. But I think the thing that I find the most fun and exciting is I get here and I get assigned to the management program, and there, you know, the courses are very, prescribed and conventional. And, you know, I had just come off of this very interesting experience launching this rum distillery in Boston. And I thought, well, why don't I provide some opportunity for cadets to start their own businesses? And that's been a lot of fun. So I petitioned the dean. And of course, they immediately said, no, we're not producing, you know, captains of industry. We're producing, you know, officers of character. And so I pushed back and said, you know, anybody who's been in combat cannot deny that an entrepreneurial mindset will keep you alive longer. It's absolutely essential that you can think beyond the boundaries of convention and innovate in ways based on what your gut tells you. And so they finally said, okay, we'll allow you to do an experimental, elective, and we'll keep an eye on you. So I started the elective, and I built it so they came, and I've just been overwhelmed by the number of cadets who are interested in entrepreneurship and who are doing so well. I think our first year, which was 2015, I entered 5 teams in the Mid-Hudson Regional Business Plan Competition, and 4 of those teams won first prize in their categories and were propelled to the state championships. And of those 4 teams, 1 won the state championship. And over the next couple of years, of all the teams that have been competing, we've launched 5 businesses that are viable and doing great. Now, one of the challenges, of course, is that the United States citizenship does not pay these cadets to create businesses. They pay them to become leaders of character. So I have to get clearance through the JAG office, the lawyers, who carefully monitor me in terms of the cadets' prize money and what they do with the business after they graduate. So now, under the guidance of the lawyers, I require that cadets have a civilian counterpart to run the business if they win in their category. Because, of course, they win seed money from investment bankers. And so in all of these companies that have been started, those lieutenants are out there serving in the Army, but they have civilian partners who are running the businesses. And it's just been a win-win. It's really been very exciting. And I think I'm convincing the dean that this is good leadership development for combat leaders.
And you've said that even within the military, that there is a great opportunity for entrepreneurship and to make make an impact. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think people lose sight of how change is possible in big organizations.
Yeah, I think it's very easy if you're passive to just go along with standard operating procedures. But often when you're in a big, stilted, hierarchical organization, if you're paying attention, you will see a lot of white space that where you could actually add value and you could reduce inefficiency. And I think entrepreneurship, in order to make the case for change, you've got to make the case that you're making the business better or the organization better and more effective, whether it be, you know, increasing profit margin, reducing waste, you know, as a Six Sigma expert or something like that. And I found that when I wanted to introduce something that was sort of innovative and unpopular, as long as I could align the purpose of my mission with the purpose of the organization at large, then there really was no arguing with me. Just case in point, when I was in Alaska, I was approached by the University of Alaska, and they told me that they had been monitoring a, 8-billion-year-old ichthyosaur fossil. And an ichthyosaur is a ancient porpoise type creature. And there was this fossil that was stuck in the Brooks Range, way up high in the Brooks Range, and it was being exposed by erosion. And they had been trying to raise the funds to get that thing exhumed from the mountain and flown back to the University of Alaska Museum in Fairbanks. And so I was talking to this mad scientist at a cocktail party, and I just thought, well, that my unit can totally do that. You know, I had 250 soldiers and 18 Chinooks. And, you know, that was right up our alley. And so I petitioned the Army, you know, I submitted the requests up through legal review, et cetera. And of course, immediately was denied. And I kept pushing back and saying, this is one of the richest training opportunities, because it's going to require of my flight engineers and crew chiefs a lot of creativity. And it's not unlike some of the wild missions that we'll get in combat. Like, this is very unconventional, and it's a great training opportunity. So I kept pushing back. And finally, they said, okay, do it. And so we spent 2 years with multi-phased operations going up into the Brooks Range and exhuming this fossil out of the side of this cliff and, you know, lifting it out with Chinooks. And I think my soldiers just had a wonderful time. And, you know, I'll just never forget the day that we flew it back into, you know, we landed right on the grounds of University of Alaska and plopped it out on their lawn and said, here you go. But I'll never forget that. And it was a wonderful training opportunity. And I was actually creating more effective combat operators by doing that, because, you know, it demanded of these kids a lot of creativity and innovation to get this thing in one piece out of that mountain and back to the city. So I think that's what you have to look for when you're an entrepreneur, is those white spaces where what you're asking to do is unheard of, but it's still in alignment with the mission of the organization, which in my case was training soldiers for combat.
You've been studying leadership in a variety of ways forever, you know, since your first
right.
since your first days, even when you were a cadet at West Point. What's something that you understand now about leadership that maybe you wouldn't have, you know, years ago? Like, what kind of comes to mind?
I think this idea of leading from behind. I think that's very counterintuitive based on sort of the stereotype of what leadership looks like follow me. But I find that letting my soldiers take the lead actually creates a lot more empowerment across the whole organization. And so I really try to get out of the way of my soldiers. And I know that my mission is to, like, I know that I'm successful. I'm the most successful when I become obsolete. Meaning that if I get shot in combat, that my soldiers, hopefully, you know, they'll say, gee, we're going to miss her, but they will be able to pick up the mission and drive on without me. Like, a leader who's indispensable has failed, in my mind. I think what you need to do is create the capability on your team and in your units, so that if you were to drop dead, they can drive on without you and the mission can be achieved. So that, to me, was one of my biggest learning aha moments, if you will, in the Army, was to lead from behind.
And you've also, looked a lot at behavior in leadership. Is there something that people don't really understand or sort of overlook when it comes to sort of the power of understanding people's behavior?
The only blindness that I see is when leaders think it's about them. And I think that's a really powerful failure. Leaders who can't get out of their own center of gravity will always get in the way of their soldiers growing and developing. And so I think that's one of the big things to look for if you're a leader, is it's not about you.
Through most of your story here has been sort of about pushing forward and sort of having that courage to try to do it one more time, right? You applied to 20 schools, apply again. You wanted to go to West Point, you try again, you know. And you've said to me that courage is just fear that hung on a moment longer. What does that mean? If you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that's always been sort of one of my bylines. And I think it's because, you know, we have this stereotype or this concept or this construct of what courage is. And it And it's not near as romantic as the popular image is. And I have found the most courage when I'm just willing to hang on to my fear 1 minute longer. And what that looks like is I just lean into the fear and I learn to be comfortable with that horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach, because I know that if I hang on, I'll get to the other side of that fear. And on the other side of that fear is actually what debunks the mythology of the fear in itself. And we call that courage, I think. It's hard, you know, it's pretty an abstract concept, but in the physical, like if you were to live it physically, it's really about, you know, diving into that pit in your stomach and finding that that everything's all right anyway. But nonetheless, anything that I've really been afraid of, I've actually moved toward. And in that philosophy, I've always found that my fears are much bigger than they actually are. My thought of the fear is much bigger than it actually is. And I think West Point taught me that, because West Point demands of you to do things that you know, any normal citizen would never do. And I think the Army does too. They demand of you physical actions and, you know, emotional actions that a normal person would much rather just sit on the couch and not do. But when you step into it, it adds a layer of confidence and competence, and that's just invaluable. And any time that I've ever shrunk from a fear, I've always felt the loss. There's always a loss in respecting your fear.
You, for folks who, you know, haven't been through the rigors of, say, a military training and aren't used to being uncomfortable in the ways that some experiences can make them uncomfortable, how can they manage their own fears? They may not even realize that they're fears. How can mm-hmm. they manage them?
I think one thing is to be reflective and think about what scares you the most. And if typically it's around failure, I think. And I would encourage people to fail hard and often, and realize that on the other side of failure, it's not the end of the world. And often you walk out of a failure much more competent and capable than you were before the failure, because it's such a beautiful opportunity to learn. If you remain safe, you won't learn anything. And so I think that's the big thing that I would encourage folks who, you know, aren't getting shot at, but just, you know, do stuff that is uncomfortable, because it'll teach you something about yourself. And moving forward beyond that, you'll be much more confident and competent about different, you know, different challenges and you know, your willingness to take on challenges will change. So I think if I were to put it into practical terms, I would say when you're at work, you know, be the shitty little jobs officer, if you will. Like, take on jobs you would rather not have and learn. And fail at them and get better at them and become indispensable to your organization. Because oftentimes the shitty little jobs are the ones that are the most neglected, but the most valuable in terms of learning about the whole organization. So, you know, I say do that. Volunteer, you know, always and often.
Well, that's all the time we have, Lissa. But it's been just a delight and an honor to chat with you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. My honor. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for all your time. And for those listening, to listen to more podcasts from this series, find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and follow us on SoundCloud.